Do you sometimes struggle to get up in the morning or wind down for bed at night? I used to find it so difficult. I woke up with no sense of positivity and brightness. I was void of motivation and spirit. This changed completely when I started waking up with a Lumi body clock. These incredible devices mimic the light and color of a real sunrise and sunset, transforming the experience of waking up and going to sleep completely. Rather than being suddenly woken up with an alarm clock, the Lumi body clock will wake you up gradually with a natural sunrise. The Lumi body clock has been shown to improve the quality of sleep and awakening and to boost mood and productivity in clinical trials. You can personalize your sunrise and sunset from 15 to 90 minutes with their clinically tested unique natural light and more than 20 sleep and wake sounds. We all deserve to sleep well and to wake up feeling fresh. So if you're finding this a challenge and you want to try a new approach, go to lumi.com.
We're going to go through some of your work today, Jay, because obviously I knew you'd played on a lot, but some of the records are actually, I had no idea that you'd played on some of these songs that are so famous. And you might not recall all of them because you've played on thousands and thousands of records. But I wanted to start off by talking, because it's just fresh in my mind, about Donna Summer and Bad Girls. I mean that record's all about the guitar to start with. So do you have any recollections of those sessions?
I remember that one. And the reason I do remember it is because, why do I remember it? Because it was a hit? Maybe. Anyway, when we're doing rhythm dates, rhythm section dates, a lot of times the parts aren't written out. Typically, it's just chord changes. And we'll either hear a demo of the song or not. Or the arranger may play piano and sing the melody with the basic chords. I don't remember, I don't think we got to hear the melody. Because actually, when I listened to the record, I wouldn't have stopped that single line guitar part where I did. It was the chart, the way the chart was written, it wasn't laid out to like what was the verse and chorus clearly. It wasn't clearly laid out. So when I went to chord changes and got off the line, it's in the middle of a chorus, I think. I have to go back and listen to find out, but
Would that have all been done live, like everybody playing at the same time? Yeah.
yes.
And what were the players? So it would have just been chords and a melody, and any indication as to groove or what it should sound like?
Well, first of all, we know with Donna that
The Groovy
everything was going to
Disco.
be dance stuff unless it was a ballad, right? So knowing that, it's four on the floor, meaning bump, 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 bump with the kick drum, right? And backbeat two and four and whatever the tempo is. But knowing that it's a dance groove, so, and it's going to have a little bit of R&B funk to it. So with that in mind, instead of just playing the chords, coming up with a rhythm that I did later, well, which I did later in the song, or in different sections, the chord should have been in the verse and the bump 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 da dunk da 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 the part, something like that. And I just go, okay, I found the line, so I'll sit on this line, and that's my contribution to make it not sound totally stock with just chords, to give it a little bit of oomph,
It's
right?
more important to the groove, I mean, or as important as the drums. I mean, I would say more important. Like in all of that stuff, and in all kind of disco sounding records, for example, by Earth, Wind & Fire, like the guitar part is always crucial to the groove, right?
Rhythm guitar, man. 85% of what any guitar player does is to play rhythm guitar or a single line rhythm thing, a little sometimes semi-muted with the hand on the back of the strings. And in this case, it was the pendulum thing, I call it. So my right hand is not stopping. So even when there's rests, the groove keeps going, right? And it's difficult to mute the high two strings and the low two strings while I'm playing on the middle two strings. It's tricky to mute. I'm using my right hand to deaden the top two, and I'm using my thumb and part of my right hand to deaden the two low strings so they won't ring. And there's a way to cheat this, but by using foam rubber and sticking it on the C sharp fret way up high at the neck. I do this now because I'm old and lazy and I'm not playing all the time. So I don't, you know, I mean, I'm rusty. So this is it's not cheating. It's just an easier way to do it. But back then I was used to it.
You wouldn't have been cheating also in the sense that, I mean, would any of it have been like copied or like cut or would have just the whole track you're playing all the way through?
The whole track.
I mean, that sounds so, it's sad in a way that sounds so foreign, but like now I'm imagining if they were to do a disco record like that, they'd get a few bars of the verse, few bars of the chorus, copy and paste it for 4 minutes.
That's not what was happening back then. Although there was some drum loops, and we'll get into that in a minute. And
do you think anything is lost by the way that people are flying everything around? People fly around parts that are the same. So even when the variations are small, like you still had little variations in the old days, and people are obviously flying like backing vocals all the time.
It's unreal. I mean, I'll tell you a story. Lee Sklar was doing an overdub for a guy, and after the first chorus, the guy stopped Pro Tools, or whatever he was using for this DAW, right? And the guy said, okay, we're done. I'll just fly it all in, right? I'll fly the verse in, fly the chorus in, right? All fly-ins, right? And Sklar says, look, I don't care what you do after I leave, but let me play the whole song straight down, would you? So Sklar did. You know, and if I was the guy, I would have kept it.
Now you can. Damn right.
You can, you know, if you fly stuff in, you also have to do some time shifting if you're using real drums. And man, I'm going to get into this big time on my YouTube educational channel that will be starting in about a month, finally.
All right, wow.
This is going to be a big part of it because you can do all this stuff and you can really help drum sounds. And help you can help the sonics of the whole record be incredibly better by what I'm going to teach. It's all about physics, both physical and electronics. And when you see what's happening, it's going to change the way you'll think about how records are made. The bottom end on records is totally destroyed if not paying attention to these physics rules. Not destroyed, but there's a lack of it. Briefly, I'll tell you one thing. A loudspeaker can only move air in one direction at a time. On the first half of cycle of the waveform, like let's say you see a sine wave. That's one cycle of a waveform, of a sine wave. Starts at the center point of the box that you see it in Pro Tools, you know, whatever. And it starts up, and then it goes down, crosses the zero point, and comes back up and stops at the zero point. That's one cycle. Let's say that's a bass note, okay? Since a speaker can only move air in one direction at a time, we want the woofer to move forwards at the bass attack. The same with the kick drum. We want to see the waveform moving up, which in turn, if everything is electronically coherent in your chain, that will push the woofer towards you at the very first half of the first cycle. Now, let's say it was inverted. Let's say the wiring was flipped or it's a physics issue. That's a long story that I'll get into because it's all about that. Let's say the waveform from the center of the line went down across the center point and then went up and then came back down and continues, right? Over and over and over. Okay. That would pull the air in towards the back of the speaker cabinet on the woofer. Well, all speakers, but we're mainly talking about bass frequencies, which would be in the 200 to the floor, you know, 30 cycles, whatever. It's so important to move the air forward at attack instead of having it be sucked back. Believe it or not, it makes a difference. And I put myself in an accidental blind test finding that out 45 years ago when I was mixing. Another long story that will be included on the channel. But the bottom line is we want air, The bottom line is we want air moving forward at attack, especially on the woofer. That means the phase coherency is correct, and you'll see that waveform rise up and then fall down. So the first thing I do when I'm working on the phase of the song, let's say I recorded in Pro Tools, which I always use now, and I use sample drums, okay? Well, I've opened a can of worms here, but I'm gonna go through it. Let's back up for a second and imagine a snare drum. Here's a snare drum, right? Okay? It's mic'd from above at the top edge of the snare drum, okay? When you hit that drum, it vibrates, right? Because it's all about vibrations, you know, that create a pitch. The lower the frequency, the slower the vibrations occur, right? So on a snare drum, it's tuned fairly low, not low, low. So that head is vibrating when you hit it. So a microphone, such as this microphone right here, when it sees air moving towards the diaphragm, that interprets it as a positive cycle in your DAW. So if I went, I'm pushing air towards the mic, and if we look at that waveform on our DAW, we're going to see the waveform rising. That means the whole electronic chain is phase coherent. Okay, all the wiring's proper, right? So air towards the capsule vibrates the capsule, starting with the capsule going backwards, with air moving towards it. Well, we want the opposite with the speaker. We want the speakers to move air forward. And this is the way they're wired, and this is the way the phase chain, this is the way the electronic chain works. Okay? So now, back to the snare drum. When we hit the snare drum, which way is the air moving as far as the microphone's concerned? Here's the snare, here's the mic, at the top edge of the snare. When you whack the drum, what's the first impulse the mic sees air-wise?
Well, it's going towards the mic.
Wrong.
Right. Away.
No, you're wrong. This is how all this started. Okay. When you hit the head is being pushed down.
Oh, right,
and then it vibrates back up and vibrates back down and back up to however long the snare will dwell. When you put tape on a snare drum hit so it won't dwell.
Right,
which is what we did because we didn't want that open rock and roll sounding for the R&B stuff. Even for the rock stuff, we didn't really use open snare back then. But back to the point of this, when you hit the snare head's moving down. So the air that's moving towards the mic is not moving towards the mic. It's sucking in. The mic is interpreting the air movement as negative pressure because the air is coming backwards. But then in the second half of the first cycle, the air now goes towards the mic, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at the snare drum, when you look in Pro Tools, the very first hit, you'll see that the snare drum is moving negative. We don't want that. So we're gonna invert the phase of the top snare head. There's a couple of ways to do that, but after the fact, there's only one, which is we go into Pro Tools. All right, let me back up. So if we look at that first attack of the snare, it's going negative. And so what we're going to do is highlight the whole track. We're going to go into Audio Suite, and under Audio Suite, we're going to go to Other, and then in Other is a function called Invert. So I highlight the whole snare track, top snare, and I click invert. Now, the negative waveform that happened when the snare was hit is now moving positive, pushing the woofer air towards the listener. It's important, believe it or not, it's important. Now, we typically mic the snare in the bottom too, right? So we've got two mics, one on top and one on the bottom. But since the top mic is seeing air move in a negative direction, the bottom mic seeing air move in a positive direction. So the actual bottom mic is correct phase. They invert the bottom mic. They throw the phase reverse to invert it on the bottom mic, okay? What they should be doing is inverting the top mic and not doing anything with the bottom mic, because the bottom mic is correct phase. Phase means polarity. Phase is a shortcut studio term. It's really polarity. So the bottom mic is seeing the air move towards the diaphragm, which is what we want. The top mic seeing it move negative. So we flip the phase and or invert the phase. If we're recording out in front and using a console with phase switches that can invert, I invert it for the recording. So it's right from the beginning,
mm-hmm.
right? And so anyway, that's the story with that. Now then, the bottom head and the mic head need to be lined up as to the transient of the attack. This is where I have to stop for now, because it's all visual and sonic at this point. It's both visual and sonically the only way to do this right. But with that in mind, it's going to change the way everyone deals with mixing or recording from now on. If you follow my instructions, your sound is going to be much bigger in the bottom end.
Mm.
And I'm just getting started, because not only the snare that we deal with, we're dealing with the whole drum set. We're dealing with the bass and the kick working together to make sure there's no phase cancellation there. But it's very, you have to manipulate, meaning sliding around the tracks, never more than a half a sample, so it won't affect the time or the feel. I know I got way too deep right off the bat.
No, but it's very helpful. Also, I think these days, you mentioned about sample drums. Do you think that, like, there's anything in it for people to record drums? I mean, I think the answer is yes, but do you think that people should try and stay away from sample drums if they want to make really great records? Because I know you've made some very good records on your solo album that were sampled. Like, I didn't know when I first listened to, like, Roxanne, for example, that those were sample drums that you
did. It's all about the programming. Have you listened to the Jar album?
Yep.
Myself and Randy Goodrum?
Was that all programmed as well?
Yes. And the new one that I've been spending, that I have not mixed yet, I'm so sorry, everyone. I'm going to get on this. It's a long story.
But so you're sitting on a new Jar album?
Oh, it's done. I just have to mix it. It's been done for 5 years.
Yeah.
I just keep getting hung up doing other stuff, paying gigs. You know, because the Jar album's not, it's a vanity record, man. This is too musical. It's not for the typical pop audience. The Steely Dan audience would appreciate it.
Well, that's the audience. There's a big Steely Dan audience.
Well, hopefully they can discover the Jar album, which is spelled capital J, small a, capital R. And Randy's daughter, Sarah, who's a genius, said, well, Randy said, we're looking for a name. And Sarah said, how about Jar? J, A, J, A, R, Jay and Randy. Pretty obvious.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's musical stuff with intelligent lyrics. We'd come up with a topic, like I was telling Randy about, I had this horrible ex-girlfriend, and to get her to leave cost me a lot of money. And and her lawyer was literally one of the worst human beings I've ever known in my life. Just unbelievable. So the song is called Esquire. And, well, we'll play it. We'll play it in a bit.
So you're not going to play any of the unreleased stuff then?
No. Now, I'll give you a 4-bar teaser of something that I'm going to use, which is, this is very important, for my YouTube channel. On Sunday mornings, I work with two guys, Cheriston's two sons, Stefan and Pepe, who are both incredible, who are both incredible musicians. Stefan is a keyboard player and Pepe's a drummer. These guys also know music history because they grew up with their mom and dad, who are also musicians and singers. Kirsten's a very good singer, and she plays some guitar, and her husband, Lage, is a very good guitar player. So they grew up listening to what has become yacht rock. Back then it was called West Coast Pop.
Mm.
It was named that in Japan by a guy who I'm now very good friends with. Whatever he said in print stuck. And when the Airplay album came out, he says, "This is a new style of music," and he called it West Coast Pop, and it stuck.
Yeah, and a lot of people still call it that. I mean, the yacht rock stuff started from that YouTube series, but whatever you call it, I mean, it's the caviar of music.
It's a good thing it has a name, because now young people, when they hear about yacht rock, they can look it up and see which records are included. And ironically, Airplay is always in the top three or five of, you know, but we didn't really start this style because the drummer is Jeff Porcaro and the bass player is David Hungate and me on guitar, of course, and Foster on keyboards, of course, so
two,
right?
Two future members of Toto.
It's two members of Toto, you know, but it's just our melodic input instead of what David Page and Luke, the songs they were writing for their melodic input.
Would you say that Toto are yacht rock?
Oh, yeah. Now, this is what I told David Page at Lukather's son's wedding about 3 months ago. I'm Luke's son's godfather, Trevor Lukather.
Yeah, yeah. And he's released,
great guy, man.
Released a new album. He's come on the podcast, Trev.
Oh, man. Trevor is a great human being.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Luke's like a real brother. I mean, clearly like a true real blood brother.
Yeah,
we've
yeah.
always been there for each other when we've had, you know, ex-wife, girlfriend, other problems, whatever. We're always there for each other, always. It's the love is beyond words. So at Trevor's wedding, I was talking to Paige about songwriting. You know, he always says, "Man, After the Love Has Gone," one of the greatest songs. I go, "David, you want me to just go down the list of all your songs? I love every one of them." You know, there was a song called Miss Sun that Bob Skaggs recorded. And David used the pop, those kind of West Coast pop changes, you know, more melodic, jazzy. For a lack of a better term, they're jazz chord changes.
Yeah.
Now, Page can do that. But I thought of something. He had written the song Miss Sun for Boz, and Lisa Del Bello sang it with him. And it's loaded with pretty chord changes. Jazz chord changes. You know, because his dad was a jazzer. So David grew up with that. And David's a great jazzer. He can play anything. I said, "Man, all of your songs are much simpler chord change-wise." I said, "What you did is you never wrote past the money." Meaning, I have a tendency to write complex chord changes in songs, right? I just can't help myself. Every once in a while, I can simple it up, like Turn Your Love Around. But there's still hip chord changes in that, even though it's pretty stock. The turnaround, there's, you know, flat five, sharp nine, sharp five. I can't remember it. I have to analyze it. But, yeah, man, he just was smart and kept it not too complicated chord change wise. And yeah.
Is that the key to pop music, do you think? Like,
simple.
Keep it simple.
Memorable melodies over hip chord changes work. That's how we got away with a lot of songs, you know, like Turn Your Love Around, even though there are some hip chord changes in there.
Yeah, but, yeah, for sure.
But the key is the melody and the lyric, of course. So if you're going to use hip changes, you got to have memorable melodies. You can't make them too jazzy and, you know.
When you're doing those tracks, where does the melody come into it? I mean, are the chord changes already there? Or are you starting from a melody? Or is it
melody.
Kind of both at the same time?
No, actually both. Sometimes the chord changes. Sometimes I'll come up with a pattern I like and I'll base it on that. Or I'll just come up with a melody and, you know, actually, man, I come up with melodies when I'm not playing guitar or piano. If I come up with a melody idea I like, I'll immediately run to the cassette recorder. I still use those, and of course the iPhone voice memos and whatever. But I'll just sing the melody so I don't forget it. And then after I've done that and I come back to it later that day or the next day, whatever, then I'll start working out the changes with it. You know, and I have a tendency to go with the hip stuff because my mind wants that. You know, but thankfully, man, a lot of the stuff still sold well, even with the hip changes.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Like Giroux, you know.
It's very difficult to make those records that have brilliant melodies, but where the harmony is getting very complex.
It
but
is.
The listener can't, because the listener can tell when it's just people writing complicated chord changes for the sake of it and without the song in mind.
You
it doesn't
have
sound as satisfying to the ear.
Tell me that again,
It
Tom.
Doesn't sound as satisfying to the ear when people are just putting in those chord changes gratuitously with no thought as to the melody. So that must have come naturally to you where, like, you can put in these chords, but it's not kind of making the song unlistenable.
It's just the way I think musically. But I can't help it.
Toto tracks are definitely a lot less complex chord-wise from what I've seen.
That's right.
Like, something like Rosanna is, I mean, people talk about the drums.
The groove.
The famous groove. But, like, the chords are basically just triads, I think, a lot. And moving around quite a lot from, you know, one to four.
Paich didn't write... What was my line?
Beyond the money.
When he wrote tunes, man, he didn't write beyond the money. You know, Toto songs. But then there's Miss Sun. You look at that, you know, too bad I can't get Pro Tools working right now because the changes are really pretty. But, you know, he's got that ability. He's just smart enough to not go by the money, you know. There's some tunes in the Airplay stuff that we intentionally try to write simple, like Stranded. There's only, that whole tune started with two chord changes on the walk-up that gets us back to the one chord. I would have to play it. We'll play it, and I'll dissect it and figure out what it was. But yeah, man, the bottom line is memorable melodies and great lyrics. That's the key.
Mm.
In pop these days, man, the melodies have basically just chopped themselves down to the five. Well, it's not really a pentatonic scale. The pentatonic scale includes the six, but the melodies are mostly 1, 2, 3, 5. You know. If that's C, I should be close. 1, 2, 3, 5. Sometimes the 4. Sometimes the dominant 7th. But 1, 2, 3, 3, 2, 1. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Or 1, 2, 3, 5. That's typical for the pop stuff.
I mean, there's not... In most pop records that I hear nowadays, there's very little redeeming quality to it. I don't get that. But people have been dumbed down. And we were talking about that kind of great era of yacht rock or West Coast pop or whatever you want to call it. There are some, because obviously Toto is still touring and everybody knows Toto, but there's some people, bands and artists whose records you've played on that are kind of like niche. They've still got these fan bases, but I really wanted to ask you about them. Like, first of all, the band Pages.
Yeah.
What's the story there? Like, incredible records, like, outrageous.
Really musical, man. You know, there's chord changes for you all over the place. And one of the
and
songs,
melodies.
What?
And melodies.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Outrageously
man.
Good melodies. It doesn't matter whether the chord, because some people don't, I don't even like some jazz. Like, when it's just musicians trying to show off, but those guys, you know, people who don't know anything about chord changes would just think, oh, it's the same as, like, the Bee Gees or anything. You know, it's cheesy.
Yeah.
But it's not.
It's not.
At all. Did you play throughout their records?
Oh, I played on the songs that I produced on most of the songs. No, they did one tune later, I think, and they recut it. Yeah. The tune that I like the best on that album for commercial sake is the ballad. Well, it's not a ballad. You name the songs on the record.
I'll have to get them up. I mean, Who's Right, Who's Wrong is one of their big hits.
That was before me, right?
I think so. The one that Fearless.
That's a good tune. I think I wrote that with him. What's the name? Some more. There's one really pretty poppy song that I thought should have had a shot at a hit.
If I Saw You Again.
Keep going. You
Need a Hero. Sailor's Song. Let It Go. Was it from the Pages record?
Yes, Pages. Pages, the band, and Pages is the name of the album.
Because they made two Pages records.
Two.
You Need a Hero.
Me.
Tell Me. Official Cat of the 80s. Come On Home.
Come On Home. That should have been a hit. If they would have had a that was the shot.
Did they never have a hit?
Not as Pages.
And they were two guys.
Yeah. Rich Page, incredible singer, incredible writer, incredible musician. He plays a lot of instruments well. Piano, guitar, bass.
And they had hits, but just not as Pages.
Mister.
Yeah. Well, they both were Mister.
Yeah, Mister is Pages.
So they just rebranded.
Yeah.
It's not as good. I don't like Mister as much as Pages, though.
Well, they simpled it up. And they had some hits.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome, bro.
I don't understand how Pages wasn't successful, though. Because it's just as catchy. But, I mean, there's so many records.
It's too musical, man. And the one
but
I
loads
did
of stuff
them,
was musical in the 70s. Like Steely Dan was very musical. Why were they so successful?
First of all, Donald's voice is very recognizable.
That's true.
And they started out with some pretty simple stuff for hits, but they sell a lot of albums, you know. I mean, Peg was a simple song. Basically, it's blues with major seventh chords and add two chords over the third and the bass.
It's the musicianship on every level is just astonishing.
Studio cats, man.
You've got the guitar solo.
Stop, man, please.
Well, I'm not even going to, you know, the groove is outrageous.
The groove.
Michael McDonald backing vocals.
Oh, yeah, man.
It's just got everything. But it is just kind of like not a blues, but it's like...
It's a blues progression with major seventh to an add to. Like, the song's a G, okay? So the first chord is C major 7, and then it goes to a G2 over B. Those are pretty chords.
Who played the drums on Peg?
Rick Murata, and I'll tell you the story. They probably recorded that track 6 times, maybe 7 times, with different rhythm sections. Typically Chuck Rainey on bass, but what they were, and Carlton on guitar, used to do the takedowns for him from the demos. And what they were looking for is a drum groove that worked for them. And when they finally got to Rick, that the hi-hat pattern on that tune is the groove. It's perfect for that song.
It's such an incredible groove. I mean, that was the case for a lot of their songs. They worked with really good drummers. So they just worked with session guys. It was just the two of them.
Right.
Walter and Donald.
Right.
It's a great way of running a band in a way.
They got along.
Minimize the fallouts, and you get to work with a variety of players.
They started with a band, but it was always them. They started as two songwriters on ABC Dunhill, I think they made a publishing deal with. And I don't know how they ended up doing an album, but they did. And there was another singer other than Donald in the beginning. Donald sang some of the stuff. I can't remember the guy's name. But... And Jeff Baxter was in the band, and Denny Diaz, great guitar player. He's a bebopper. And Walter played bass, and Donald played drums. I mean, Donald played keys. And I don't know the drummer that they had originally, but they branched off from that, and it just was them. I think maybe the first two albums were band guys. Is that right?
And then from there, it was session players all the way through.
They first got my attention big time with the Katie Lyde record. I was on a record date with Jeff. But it was on the lunch break, right? Like a lot of sessions would be double sessions. that started at 10 a.m., so 10 to 1, hour off for lunch, 2 to 5. And then usually 6 or 7 to 1 in the morning would be the night gigs. You know, I used to do 4 a day a lot.
How many studios were in operation in LA for that? Like way more than that.
A lot, yeah.
And what were the ones that are still in existence that you were going into? Like Sunset Sound, maybe?
Sunset Sound still in existence. I've got to do an interview with Drew for that. He asked me to do it, and I've got some stories about that place, man. Let me tell you.
What, Sunset Sound?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Village, Capitol. Capitol's not being used right now. It's down because they're earthquake-proofing the building.
But they'll keep that in operation forever, right?
Probably. It, you know, even though it doesn't really make money, when record companies weren't in there renting the space, renting offices, they would rent to anybody that wanted office space. And when you enter the building, especially if you come the back way, you go right by the studios. So it's just the fact that, oh, my office is in the Capitol recording studios, right?
It's awesome if you're in the music biz. But then again, despite the fact that is an incredible building and, you know,
oh, yeah,
loads of heritage all the way from, you know, the 50s stuff kind of, yes, gives it a little bit more even.
Yeah.
But it's like, it's right in the middle of Hollywood.
Right in the middle, man.
And I mean, sad to say, but like same deal with Sunset Sound.
Yes.
It's like these museums to pop culture are right in the middle of an area that's just been completely shot to pieces.
Conway is another studio that had been around, but it wasn't successful in the early days. And the engineer in that studio at the time was Buddy Brundo. And I remember Buddy coming up to me. We were good pals. He was, you know, we'd shoot the breeze after sessions. It was really a nice cat, man. We got along well. And he came up to me one day on a break and he says, the owner wants to sell this place. I'm thinking of buying it. And Buddy was an okay engineer, but not great. I mean, he'd work. He would, you know. I'm sorry, buddy, I'm not putting you down, man. You were good. You just weren't in the upper echelon of the top five guys or whatever. But I thought, Buddy is such a good guy. He'll be a great studio owner. He'll, you know, he's a smart cat, and his wife's smart. And so when he bought Conway and then he developed it into a bunch of different studios, you know, he bought the property next door, then he bought another property behind it. It's like an oasis in a real not safe part of town of Hollywood. It's like right next to Purgatory. You know, I mean, literally, it's 3 blocks later is not good. So Buddy built up the clientele. The word got out. That's a real good studio. Yeah, So Village, Capitol, Sunset Sound, Conway. Let's see what's left. Record Plant. Is there anything left of that? Or West...
What did the record plant get bought? I don't think it doesn't exist.
What's the studio that's the gear rental company that Westlake Audio? Record Plant may have turned into Westlake, the actual building, the first or second building. What other ones are left? I don't even go to Hollywood hardly ever. I don't ask the guys where they're working. You know, I don't even know what's left. You know,
I mean, people still put, record companies put big money into a tiny little percentage of pop stars. And they do go and record in these places.
Yes.
Because I went to Sunset Sound over the summer and they said that they were doing a Miley Cyrus record and stuff. And these people will have session players and they'll be able to do whatever they want. But I don't know whether there were way more studios that are now defunct.
Yeah, they. What happened, man, is when home studios came around, you know, and DAW recorders or even the ADATs. By the way, make sure I talk about ADATs and their format, because I was a consultant on this, as I've always been, for Marcus Ryle. Genius cat. Well, I'll just tell you now. The ADATs are the only digital recorder that I know of that actually has a true analog bypass, meaning you can jump the converters. I should say it like this. When Marcus hired me for the gig, you know, as a consultant and a beta tester, the first thing I told him was, we have to eliminate the converters because they cause latency. Even though it's a couple of milliseconds, for a singer, when you're hearing yourselves in the earphones, the note that you sang 2 milliseconds ago is coming back into the earphones in your, you know, to your ears and your head, and it's vibrating your head to the frequency you sang. But now you're singing another frequency. So this is like vibrating your head bones to the pitch you sang 2 milliseconds ago. And it gives this kind of a comb filtering effect that sounds like you're singing in a fishbowl. I'll explain comb filtering in full on my YouTube channel. Anyway, so the first thing I told Marcus was we need a true analog converter jump bypass. So the signal comes into the ADAT, like let's say the, you know, vocal mic or recording a band, whatever. Every instrument that comes in, there's a mode to bypass the converters so you don't hear the converters in the monitors and you don't hear them in the control room. You're just hearing the analog out. Okay, so it's straight through. Analog in, analog out. Like the converters are doing their work on their own. And this is the only way to do this properly. There's a way to do it with Pro Tools and other DAWs, and I'll explain it all on my YouTube channel.
Yeah, I'm very excited about your YouTube channel, Jay, because I think it's going to be a new kind of Rick Beato, but I mean, also you've got that history of having played on so many hits, so you say you're going to start it in a month.
About a month, things will start to be released. I want to get a stockpile of stuff ready to go. First of all, remind me what I'm doing tomorrow night. Rick Beato and I are very much alike. We're both musos, you know. We both don't have perfect pitch, but we wanted it. And you can't develop
it. So he works for it.
Well, did you see the video on how he taught his son to have perfect pitch?
Yeah, I saw that.
His son has absolute pitch. That's very rare. He can tell the difference between A440 and A441 and A442 and A443 because Rick taught him ever since he was in the womb. That's an incredible video. Anyway, so Rick and I are so much alike. You know, we have the same kind of brain, musical brain. We're very similar on that level.
Mm.
Rick's a great educator.
Yeah, yeah, what he's done is really impressive, and it's getting people interested in music, not in kind of all the crap around music. It's actually in the music itself and how to be excellent musically.
Thankfully for Rick, he's been able to build a large following, and he's really helping young cats that are growing up.
Yeah, and who want to have a resource to turn to. I mean, it's an amazing thing to have all of that on YouTube if you're young and starting out and you can't afford music lessons, because it's all there.
It's all there.
And then he has a lot of fun with it. And one thing that occurred to me when you're talking about jazzy changes and you know, extended chords, I've heard, and we've talked about in previous podcasts, you know, you've talked about your admiration for the Beatles, and there are loads of kind of successful bands and artists, you know, well, like the Eltons of this world, or people like Jeff Lynne with ELO,
yeah,
who really do not use big chords.
No.
Why do you like the Beatles when what you know, what you're capable of making yourself and what you listen to, some of the tracks that you played on, is so much more kind of musically complicated? Like how, and Toto and, you know, Lukather's really big on the Beatles as well. Why is it that people who are kind of probably more technically proficient as musicians are so drawn to stuff that's so simple?
First of all, that was my youth. When I first started playing, I played drums first and then switched to guitar pretty quick. I'll tell you that story really quick. So don't let me get off the subject, though, because we'll come back to it. I was going to be a professional bowler if I didn't discover music. At age 9, I was bowling all the time. There was a bowling alley down the block from my house. And I started getting pretty good. And by age 12, I was hustling, meaning gambling, and quickly learned I should only gamble with bowlers I knew I could beat. And we used to call it fishing them in, you know? I'd let the guy win every third game so he wouldn't bail on me and, you know, keep wanting to gamble on the games, right? But I discovered music. I discovered I had musical ability around 13, and I wanted to buy a drum set. And it was from listening to the Beatles that really got me inspired. So I went on the hustle big time and started bowling all the fish I could find. We used to call them fish. And I saved up $100 pretty quick, and I bought a used drum set. So when I got the drum set, I found out a couple of guys in my junior high school, they were guitar players, that played surf music and some forms of rock and roll. So we jammed at my pad at my mom's house. And they left their guitars that night because we had so much fun we were going to do it the next day. So we played again the next day. But since they had left their guitars overnight, I picked up one of the guitars and I figured out all the songs we played that day. And I go, I want to play guitar. So I went back on the hustle, you know, started bowling guys that were, now this time, I still started bowling guys that were the same class as me, good bowlers, right? 190 average bowlers back then was a big deal. Averaging 200 was ridiculous. I did average 200 in one league, 201 in when I was 14 in one league, but now the game's so much easier. It's a long story. But anyway, I went back on the hustle, man, and I saved up, what was it, another $200 pretty quick, and I traded that in, and I traded the drums in, and with the bread, I bought a Strat. I didn't own an amp. I borrowed it from another friend of mine in another band that had an extra amp. So I figured out all the tunes, and anyway, I became a guitar player, and then we got a drummer. That was the Veltones. Mm-hmm. We used to play the local dances, and, you know, we got gigs. And so how did this wrap in with it? So I was listening to the Beatles. I was 14 or 13, and then the Beatles came around, right? And now I'm a musician too, right? Like 6 months later. So now I'm trying to analyze the songs. Well, first of all, they never wrote the same song twice. Incredible that they had not done that. Every song has a distinct melody and chord changes. You know, they use some pretty hip chord changes, man, as things got progressive. First of all My Lovin', those are jazz chord changes.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a jazz bass line.
Yeah, it really is.
Right. Paul's walking the bass, if that's a C, so this would be B, so this would be E. So the first chord's F sharp minor, close your eyes, right? So F sharp on the bass, here's the bass line. F sharp, E, D sharp, C sharp, B, A, G sharp, F sharp, E, B, C sharp, A, D, B. He's walking the whole time. So it's like a jazz bass player. And those changes, like I say, they're hip chord changes. They're musical, melodic.
Yeah.
And that caught my attention. And in the later albums, man, if you analyze that stuff, there's a lot of tricky stuff, man. Especially around the Strawberry Fields time on that record, you know? Really some inventive stuff.
And they were very inventive, obviously, in the studio as well.
Very.
George Martin and...
Right.
They pushed a lot of boundaries there. But I guess a part of it does come down to it is just quality melodies.
And lyrics. They wrote good lyrics. They started, their lyrics got really interesting and fun.
Oh, yeah. When it comes to the personality, lyrics, there's nothing that's really...
Unbelievable.
...surpassed that because it's all them. You know, you've got talented front people and pop stars and stuff, but like a lot of the ones that came after, like obviously Michael Jackson and that type of stuff, like that's not just Michael Jackson. That's Toto or Quincy Jones,
right?
All of the people who played on that, and so, you know, so many other people who came after had so many people around them, but like the Beatles, it was George Martin and them, and that's it. isn't it?
Right.
Not a single other musician played on anything apart from Billy Preston.
They brought in some guitar players. I think Clapton.
Oh, yeah, Clapton played on Well My Guitar, yeah, of course.
There's some, you know...
But very rare, apart from him. Maybe a couple of other moments.
I think you're right.
They replaced Ringo on a tour because he got tonsillitis or something like that. But other than that, it was them all the way through. And that would be nice to see more of.
What we need is another Beatles. Here's my thoughts. Let's say a bunch of good-looking guys that are really talented writers and, you know, great musicians and great singers. If the record company pushed the button for a band like that, you know, all the young girls, the teenagers, would love these guys, no matter what they were using for chord changes, you know, hit the hipness, right?
But then the music lovers would love it as well. That's the thing. They connect the thing. Everybody to the Beatles. It was the young girls and it was the teen market and all that stuff. And
right.
And it was also people who were like full-on music nerds.
That's right.
And there's not really been anything, and certainly these days we're a million miles off that. But when did you start to cultivate your love of like more kind of sophisticated chords and that type of thing?
Right away. In school, I had a class called instrumental training. And I was looking around the music room. Yeah, I practiced guitar for an hour. And great teacher, man. This cat was a great teacher. He taught me so much. And I found a book that said Dance Band. And I said, well, what's this, Mr. Rose? He says, well, it's big band type stuff, you know, like from the 50s and 40s and 50s. And I said, well, I want to be in that band. There's a guitar book. And I noticed that there was all these chord changes in there. And I'm going, well, I know most of those. And what I didn't know, I quickly figured out. So I was in the dance band the next semester. And then a friend of mine that I was in a band with was in junior college. And he said, you got to hear this big band, man. So I went to one of the rehearsals, and it was outstanding players. They were trying to stay out of the Army. We were all trying to stay out of the Army because it was Vietnam.
Mm.
And guys were getting drafted right and left. But if you were in college, you got a deferment for a while anyway. And so when I graduated high school, I went to Valley and signed up for the big band. And everything changed, man. That changed my life. That was unbelievable. From that, there was a guy in the band named Ray Jackson, a trombone player, great arranger. And he used to do R&B dates. He used to arrange for cats that were doing R&B demos, right? Or had a little record deal or whatever. And so I was the guitar player for Ray. And I loved James Brown stuff. And, you know, when you get that tingling feeling up your spine when you hear any music that you can relate to, there's nothing like it.
Mm.
And I love the guitar parts on the James Brown stuff. I love the funk grooves. And for a white guy, man, I learned to play funk pretty quick. And I was in a bunch of bands where I was the only white guy for miles in any direction. And there was never a problem because as soon as they heard the white guy play, the white kid, meaning me, and I can play in the pocket, I'm accepted. You know, if the white guy can play, it's cool, you know? Never a problem. And I learned so much, man, playing those gigs with real R&B funk drummers, man. Same with Latin gigs. I learned those grooves, and I just love all that great feeling stuff.
Mm.
So, here I am on the demo dates or the little record deal dates working with Ray. The drummer was a cat named Al McKay. You didn't know he was a drummer first, did you?
Okay. No, we were just talking about how, you know, those guitar parts are a seminal part of the groove. Well, I mean, it kind of explains a lot that he started as a drummer.
Both of us.
Half of Earth, Wind & Fire are drummers, basically.
Yeah. So then when Al was practicing guitar, I didn't know that. He never told me. He was always the drummer in the dates and a great guy. So I show up to a date for Ray, and there's two guitar players, me and Al. And I said, I didn't know you played guitar. He said, man, well, I've been practicing. I think I'm ready. And I said, ready? Your pocket feels great. And that's when I learn how little parts coming up with either the rhythm part or a little single string James Brown kind of part, how you work those two together. And that's what Ray Parker and I became. We were a team. We got called as a team all the time. It's like, when I describe Ray to people, I say it's two brains attached, two guitars and four arms. The second Ray jumps on a part, I know exactly what to do to complement it. If he jumps on the muted part or the single line or double stop kind of part, the real cool funk stuff, then I'll go to a rhythm pattern or vice versa. Whoever gets there first, the other guy is immediately ready to make the move, and we just paired up perfectly. So anyway.
And you started playing a lot of gigs, and it sounds like a big part of your education and the way you developed your expertise was live. When did you stop playing gigs? Because I saw that awesome poster when you were promoting Airplay for the Planet.
Well, that was my band in 94 and 96.
Was that like the last tour that you've done?
Yeah. My band...
incredible lineup of people in
the band. Good. It really is. It came off well, man. Really, really good.
Where were you playing? Like Scandinavia, I saw.
Japan and Scandinavia. Japan, Sweden, and Norway. And, West Coast is, first of all, the Swedes have the ability. It's like the American, they're the Swedish version of the American, right? They didn't have any problem adapting. It's like they grew up with it. And there's tons of great Swedish musicians and singers and writers. And same with Norway. I'm doing a solo for a buddy of mine, Ole Bård, you know?
No.
OleBoURD, I think. Unbelievable talent. He can sound like Rich Page and write like Rich Page.
Wow.
Or he can do blatant funk in anything in between.
How old is he?
Probably in his late 40s, 50, yeah. Maybe early 50s. I'm not sure.
And he releases records under his own name.
Yeah, he does well.
Cool.
Yeah, I mean, he's incredibly talented, man. Really good.
I'll have to check him out.
So anyway, Al and I were working those record dates together. And then Al got in the 103rd Street, Watts 103rd Street Rhythm Band? I think that's what it was. And I think James Gatson, great studio drummer. Great drummer. I think he was in the band. And by the way, Ray Parker told me that James Gatson is an incredible singer. I never knew that. So anyway, Al was working with Gatson and Ray. Ray, the trombone player. This is my memory, man. The kid I was talking about, Ray Jackson.
Ray Jackson, Jesus, not Ray Parker, yeah.
Right. So they were in the Watts band together, and I think part of the guys went to Earth, Wind & Fire. I know Al did, right? And I don't know how long Al was in the band, but at one point, obviously, they split up, and I've never asked him about it.
Well, he tours now, I think.
Yeah, he does.
Earth, Wind & Fire Experience, yes. Featuring Al McKay.
Right. He produced Three Chick Singers. What was the name of that song?
The Emotion.
Yes.
Best of My Love.
That's it.
And then the guitar part. I mean, and Maurice White was involved with that as well.
I figured.
I think he wrote it with Al McKay.
It sounds like Earth, Wind & Fire.
I mean, I think the band is Earth, Wind & Fire.
It's gotta be.
And then they did Boogie Wonderland, and that was the Emotions and Earth, Wind & Fire kind of build as both artists on the record.
Did Allie Willis co-write that or write that?
What, Boogie Wonderland?
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Great writer, great chick. Yeah, she had some tunes on the I Am album.
The I Am album was,
Foster.
Yeah.
Foster. The brilliant David Foster.
Yeah. I mean, that to me was kind of like the hype. The best thing that he's ever done, I think. I mean, I know he's gone on to do all sorts of other very commercially successful stuff, but that was incredible.
I don't know why they didn't want Dave to do another album with them. I don't know why Maurice didn't want that.
Yeah, well, their albums tailed off in quality after that. I mean, they had another couple of good ones, but then late 80s, it's just nowhere near the same.
How many albums were there before the I Am album?
There were like four or five.
What was the first hit?
That's the Way of the World might have been one of the first hits.
Great song.
That's a fantastic song. I mean, their first album was quite a lot of instrumental stuff, and they weren't poppy at all. And then they had that producer, Charles Stepney. And then things started to become a bit more, you know, there were hits, and they evolved a bit more into a pop type of sound. And they talked, I've had Verdeen on the podcast, and he talked about the influence of the Beatles. And you know, just like not just being so jazz, because it was a kind of like world music at the start. It was just a bit of everything.
Well, it's funk based,
and then it became more fun. It became more funk at the start. It was way more kind of out there. Like I'm pretty sure the record Earth, Wind and Fire, like that, which was their first.
Was there a hit on it?
No, there was nothing on it, and it was loads of it was instrumental, and they didn't really. He wasn't singing, and Phil Bailey only came on later. He wasn't on the first record.
Ah.
So he came on, and then Maurice, yeah, it's just so good how they've got that lower tenor of Maurice, and then Phil Bailey doing all the high stuff in the chorus. I mean, there were nine people in the band, weren't they? So it was outrageous. But Foster's contribution was really where it all melded together. And your contribution as well, with arguably their best song.
We'll get to that story in a second. There was something I was going to say, and I forgot what it is. Okay, Earth, Wind, and Fire. Oh, Verdeen.
Verdeen, yeah.
I was talking to my buddy Sylvester Rivers. It's Ray's best friend, right? They grew up together. Sylvester is an incredible piano player. He was an arranger and keyboard player in the studios during our run. Worked a lot, you know. Not only that, he knows everything about everything. He's like a walking Wikipedia. He's a very bright cat, man, and just a sweetheart, right? So I said, hey, man, I'm going to hear Earth, Wind, and Fire, you know, Chicago. Well, I got a bunch of buddies in the band, like Champlin, Jason Sheff. So I said, I'm going to go hear these guys next week, man, and they're working with Earth, Wind, and Fire. And I said, you know, man, Verdeen's really a great bass player, man. He's a unique cat, right? But how can he play so well jumping around like that? And Sylvester says, you mean the Jack in the Box? It's like, boy, anything comes out of the screen, doesn't stop moving. He loses a few pounds a night on the gig.
And he genuinely is, like, playing...
Absolutely!
Yeah, I mean, I know he is, but...
He got used to it, man. He got used to moving like that. I mean, I don't know how anybody can do that and still... I wonder in the studio if he was jumping around. I mean, when you get used to something and you work it in, as long as your groove's happening, what's the difference?
He is really a fantastic... I want to see them live. I had tickets to the Hollywood Bowl thing that they did a couple of years ago with the Philharmonic Orchestra, but I thought I was going to get four tickets. Ended up getting two tickets, and I promised four tickets, like me, Debs, and two friends. Only two tickets came through, and I fucking gave them to the friends just because I didn't want to seem like a jackass, being like, "Oh, I'm going to get this. I'm going to get us into Earth, Wind, and Fire." But yeah, no, I fucking regret being a good guy. I really regret it. Damn it. But I will go and see them. So did you see them when they were touring with Chicago as well?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, yeah.
I did. And then Bill Champlin sang After the Love Is Gone with them. Well, so here's how this happened. So Foster got the gig to, you know, co-produce, or not co-produce. Did he co-produce?
Yeah. He co-produced I Am with Maurice White, I think.
Right. And he got that gig on account of Ray. They were looking for a cat, and they'd mentioned a few other really good piano players that were producers. And Ray said, wrong, man. You want David Foster. He can play R&B for real. He can play, his groove's happening. That's how he got the gig. So when they wrote, I think the first tune they wrote was In the Stone. I'm not sure. Great song, man.
Unbelievable song.
David played him After the Love Has Gone. The original title is After the Love Is Gone on the Airplay album. But we didn't release that until after Earth, Wind, and Fire because we couldn't release it first. There was an unwritten rule that when a major artist has got is holding a song, one of your songs, nobody can record it. But that rule's been broken, like Dolly Parton on Here You Come Again. I played on that same song three times in 1 week for different artists.
Really? Who are the other artists?
I don't remember. I arranged one of them for a guy I did arrangements for. But anyway, so where were we? Oh, yeah. So David sits down with Maurice and he plays him After the Love Has Gone. Either that or he gave him a rough mix of a Bill Champlin track because Bill was doing an album and Foster was producing it. Foster produced two albums. They're great. But no hits, sadly. And After the Love Has Gone was going to be on one of the records because Bill wrote the lyric.
Mm.
Right? So David called. So he plays a song for Maurice. And Foster called me up and he says, you're not going to believe this. Earth, Wind, and Fire wants to record this song. He says, you got to call Champlin and tell him that we've got to pull it from his record. I said, Bill is not an idiot, David. I'm going to call him and he's going to say, great, man, which is exactly what happened. He actually said to me, I said, look, David doesn't want to call you. He feels bad about this. So I'm taking the grunt work gig here. I'm the guy that's going to tell you the good news, the bad news, and the good news. And when I told him, he says, hey, man, I'm not an idiot. Of course we'll pull it. Let him record it.
Yeah, damn right.
Now, Maurice changed the lyric from After the Love Is Gone to Has Gone. Has Gone is grammatically correct.
Is it? Yeah.
It is.
Yeah. It is.
So, and what a lot of people don't know about this song is that the melody that you think is the melody on the Earth, Wind, and Fire version is not the melody in the chorus. That's the harmony part. And when Massenburg was mixing it, he jumped up the gain of the harmony part louder than Maurice's melody. So for those of you that haven't heard what the melody is intended to be, we're going to play it for you right now. It's a version from my album called Airplay for the Planet. At least I think that's what it's called. The original version was written with the verse being in the key of A. When Earth, Wind, and Fire recorded it, they wanted the verse in F, so it was a lower key for Maurice. But they went back to the original key halfway through the B section. The B section is also noted as the channel, and I think there's more names, but, you know, the verse, and then that little section before the chorus, we call it the B section. So in the B section of the Earth, Wind, and Fire version, to get back to the original key, there's a shotgun modulation. And what that means is, so the B section goes, hopefully that's C. So C, so C, the fourth of C is C, D, E, F, F. So, F. I can't sing it. F. So, the B section would go B flat major 7, which starts with that. Something happened along the way, right? Da 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 da. Shotgun modulation. The Airplay version went up a whole step, whereas the Earth, Wind, and Fire version from that one chord is up a sharp fourth. So for the musicians, B flat major 7. A2 over A, G minor 7, F major 7, and then A over B. And then the second half of the B section is just like the Airplay version. E major 7, D sharp minor 7, C sharp minor 7, B major 7, then chorus C minor 7. So, sorry for all that boring information. The shotgun modulation, what that means is, it's not a logical chord to use as the pivot chord to get to the second half of the B section. But there's one way to make chords jump from one to the other without your ear totally being offended. And that's what's called to use a common tone. So on the F major seventh chord, the notes in an F major seventh chord would be F bass. It all depends how you invert it. Well, I'll just go up the four note chord. F, A, C, E. The E is the major seventh, okay? So F, A, C, E is F major seventh. The B over A has two common tones from the F major seventh. And those common tones are A and E. So when the chord jumps to the sharp fourth interval, meaning F major 7 to the A chord over a B bass, the common tones again are the A and the E. Is that right? That's right. So your ear does allow it. Even though it really sounds kind of jerky, your ear allows it. Okay.
That's pretty interesting, yeah.
And the way the chorus works out from the B section is the last chord of the B section is B major 7th. And the first chord of the chorus is C minor 7th. They have a common tone. And that would be in D major, in the B major 7th chord, the A sharp is the major 7th. Sorry, wrong. The third of a B major 7 chord is D sharp. Let's call it E flat. It's the same note, just a different name. Because when we go to the C minor chord, it's the same note. That E flat's the same note. So that transition of moving the chord up a half step from B major 7 to C minor 7, that's the common tone, the E flat. It's smooth as silk. Even though that's a very weird chord structure to go from B major 7 to C minor 7. That's not typical. Anyway, that's how that works. So now what you thought was the melody is not the melody. My version, this version from the Airplay for the Planet record, this is what it sounds like.
All we could do, we were young and new, and your eyes were alive. Deep inside we knew our love was true for a while. We paid no mind to the past. We knew love would last every night. Something right would invite us to begin the dance.
Something happened along the way,
what used to be happy and sad.
Something happened along the way,
and yesterday was all that we had. All we would ever need, love was strong for so long. We never knew that what was wrong wasn't right. We tried to find what we had, but sadness was all that we shared. We were scared our affair would tear our love into
something. Along the way,
what used to be happy was sad.
Something happened along.
if you play tape backwards, it sounds like, you know, if somebody's talking, right? And the count off always sounds like, hut, 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 hut. So Joe and I recorded what we thought sounded like backwards sounds. We listened to something and tried to emulate it. And then we both took a shot at just recording it, you know, so like I would did something like this. Right? So we recorded it, flipped the tape upside down, and played it backwards. It sounded the same. It didn't work out. It just didn't work. But anyway,
I can't say I'm surprised.
Yeah, right. Right. So let me find the B section here. Here comes the B section. B flat major 7. A minor 7, D minor 7, G minor 7, F major 7, A over B, D E major 7. That's how that transition works. And here's a same note. Anyway, when I recorded this, I used a real band on the tracking date. Trissom Bowden. I don't know if David played on it. Probably did. But it just wasn't what I was envisioning. So I just built it from the bottom up. I just put down the stock drum groove with the drum samples. And Foster came over and he gave me 3 MIDI passes, meaning he played. Did he play it on acoustic piano? No. He played it, and we used the DX7 type Rode sound. And I had 3 tracks to work with, so I just grabbed the best stuff and comped it to 1 MIDI track and then recorded the Rode sound. And then I did the drum samples. Then I did the drum programming, thinking like a drummer. I was listening to Triss's fills and nuances with the hat. And I basically just did everything I could time-wise to make it feel more real. So that's how that happened. And then Kenji Sano, really good friend of mine, great guy. Since he was going to Japan with me on tour, I had Kenji play bass on the tune. And he sounds great. He's a great player. Now, there's another thing that happens. Speaking of common tones, in the chorus, you'll hear the string part doesn't change until we get to the very last chord. This was stupid on my part. We were using string samples, I think Hans Zimmer's library of strings. But the problem with legato strings and sordino strings, that means with mute. And when the violin players put their mute on their bridge, it really has a beautiful mellow sound. But the problem is, every time you tack a note, it swells up. So it's like, I didn't want the swell up each time. I figured out a way around this later, but I didn't want the swell up. So I just found the common tone that would work through all the chords to avoid a different swell every time. Like I say, there was another way I could have done it. It would have been much better. But anyway, let's listen to the common tone in the chorus. Deb, do you know the piano keyboard? Thank you. Do you know the piano keyboard? Do you play a little piano?
Oh, no. I know.
Okay, that's got to be.
Yeah, you do.
It's got to be E flat. You know where an E flat is on the keyboard?
Yeah.
Please play the E flat. Let me make sure I'm right.
On the piano.
This should be E flat. Yeah. Yeah. I was a little sharp, but close enough. Thank you, Debs. Okay, so the common tone. So when I think it starts on the second chorus, but you'll hear this E flat on the violins the whole way. I shouldn't have done that. I'm an idiot. I had another way around it and I should have done it. Anyway, I didn't think of the other way around it until a year later. So we're listening for that note an octave up and another octave up. So this note, two octaves up. Really stupid.
You can't tell on the record at all until you point it out. So that definitely is a thing of like being a perfectionist.
Right. So the whole thing is it's a common tone that works through all these chords.
But you were just saying earlier how having common tones helps
ties.
You know, helps tie it all together, makes it satisfying for the listener. So could this be a case of like being just such a perfectionist that you're just like, you hear something, oh, I could have changed that. Like, is that something that you get with a lot of your records or performances where you're looking back and you're like, oh, I wish I'd done this or that?
Not too often. Not too often. But in this case, it's amazing that a common tone actually worked through all those complex chords.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's moving around a lot.
This is like F minor 7-11. So the E flat is the seventh of F minor 7. C minor 7, F minor 7, B flat minor 7, the E flat of 11. The fourth of B flat minor 7 would be the 11th, which is the E flat. So C minor, F minor 7, B flat minor 7, E flat minor 7, A flat minor 7. In the E flat, it's the root. In A flat minor 7, it's the fifth. Then it goes A flat minor 7, B over C sharp bass to F sharp major 7. So I had to go down a whole step. Why did I have to go down a whole step? Let's see. F sharp major 7. I could have kept it for the B over C sharp. Oh, it moves on the F sharp major 7th. When it finally resolves the F sharp major 7th, that's when I had to change it, and I moved the E flat down to a D flat, actually a C sharp, same note. So anyway, it does tie everything together though, Tom.
Yeah, I wouldn't have noticed until you just said then, and then it is, you know, it's amazing that it is literally that note for so long.
It is pretty funny. Okay, so I had just bought a Yamaha Motif 76 keyboard synth. And the reason I bought this particular model was it has synth action, not this terrible hard to play piano action. But I'm getting ahead of the story here. So, I'm not a keyboard player. I did play organ and piano when I was in college. I played some gigs on organ here and there. But I'm not a keyboard player. So I don't practice on piano with the hard piano action. Most of the cats that aren't keyboard players, meaning guitar players and bass players and so forth, that write songs or are arrangers, we all play keys for the reason being to work out the arrangement. You have to have a good knowledge you have to have a knowledge of the chord changes to write a song, you know, that's beyond simple guitar open chords, right? So we all of us that do this for a living, we have to play keyboards enough to get the basic voicings for a song. And I typically write on keyboard because on guitar, especially with complex chords, I can't play the bass note and get the voicing I want. A lot of times there's too much of a stretch. It's just not practical. So I always write, unless it's a rock and roll metal, you know, three chord type song, I write on keyboards. Typically, I use my Patch, the famous E electric piano. And if you don't have that electric piano sample set, buy it. It's the best Rhodes ever. The day that I bought the Yamaha motif and set it up, my buddy Tim Hossman from Cambria, great guy, great keyboard player, great orchestrator, great composer. He happened to be over and he was messing around with the patches. I was doing something and he held down this one patch playing a D minor 7 chord. And how did he voice it? I'll know when I hear it. Anyway, there is an automatic kind of, it's kind of an acoustic guitar patch, kind of. And there's this automatic rhythm that's timed by the host. So when you play the chord, this rhythm is going to happen. And here it is. This is on the first tune on the Jar album called Cure Kit. Okay, so from his D minor chord, the second Tim split, I thought of these chord changes. And so that's how Cure Kit was written. From a patch that Tim played, just holding down the chord while the rhythm occurs, clocked by the host tempo. So literally, so, I'm just holding down. You know, but I'm going through the changes as they move. Okay, so it's D minor 7, let me see. Oh yeah, to D minor major 7, to D minor 7, to G7, whatever the changes are, I just work them out, and it's so simple just to hold down the chords. When it's time to change, move to the next one. So I recorded the MIDI. I had to tweak the MIDI a little bit to make sure that the previous chord didn't sustain into the following chord, and so forth. So that's how Cure Kit was written. Back to Tim Hossman, who is, like I say, an incredible composer, arranger, keyboard player, and all that. So when Randy and I wrote this song, is it called Donovan? Let's find out.
Donovan, yeah. Cool woman.
So, that intro, Randy played something like in the piano, just messing around. We needed an intro, and, you know, Randy just came up with this part. And I said, you know what? That would really sound good if it was orchestrated for an orchestra. Tim has all the sample libraries for everything, all orchestra stuff, you know, the strings, the woodwinds, the brass, all the percussion, everything. Name it. He's got all the programs because composers that compose for film and other stuff that needs orchestra, you have to mock it up. So I gave Tim the audio of Randy goofing around with that piano part and looking for an intro. And I said, Tim, can you voice this for orchestra? You know, just do it with your samples and we'll use it. And you've got all the freedom you want. Do anything you want. We just got to get to A minor. I think that's what you... No, it's in D minor. I think it is. Let's find out. Yeah, it's D minor. That would be a C that I whistled. So now with that in mind, listen to what Tim played, orchestrated, and recorded with all of his MIDI programs for orchestra. Thank you. put some kind of backwards effect on. What did I use it on? Let's see. Oh, that's a cymbal crash played backwards that leads into the downbeat. So as the end of the orchestral thing was happening, I wanted a real shock to like, whoop, to make that downbeat really interesting. And, you know, so it's and it chokes right where the attack is. So I played, I used a reverse, I used a plug-in. How did I do this? There's a reverse mode that you can take any audio file with and reverse it. So I just ran it through the plug, and then I lined it up time-wise with that audio file, so the actual attack of the cymbal occurs right on the downbeat of the intro, not of the band groove part, band groove intro part. You know what I mean. All right, so notice this when it happens. Simple guitar part. When it ends, I wanted to just jam into the downbeat, just slide it real quick. Simple, memorable, just looking for colors for the intro, right? So let's continue. Simple little fills, right? Okay. Across the face, a subtle hint, a lack of taste. Should I rip the set in now? Or call Donovan? He's got ice in his face. Searing on his chump change. Trying to fit in hip chord changes. There's a bunch of them. Okay, let's just go to the solo. It's the Jar album. Scene 29 is the name of the album, and it's Randy and myself, and we're Jar. So let's go to the guitar solo, and when I play this run, and it goes across to at least a couple of changes, let me listen to it first. I remember coming up with these three chord changes and I loved them and we fit them in somehow. I humbly say I like that. You'll share it until she falls in. The beginning of this guitar solo is all one note, okay? What I'm doing is I'm using pinched harmonics. So where I'm picking the string, I'm moving my hand a little bit each time to get another harmonic. But it's all the same basic note. The harmonics are so loud, it gets your attention. So bum, that's the note intended. With that in mind, listen to all the variations that happen because of the pinched harmonics. This time, you can spare it, you'll share it. You can just cut right to the beginning of the solo right here. So the first one and the third one are the same, but the second and the fourth are not. And do they sound like one note to you, or do they sound like more notes?
They sound like nothing that I've ever heard before because of the pinched harmonics.
Yeah, well, the harmonics are so loud.
It's a very original guitar solo.
Well, right, a lot of guitar players use this technique, you know. But it's usually an accident. I mean, I don't know exactly where they actually are. It's not like I have a visual reference. I just pick till I find one, and then if I'm looking for another one, okay, I've got to move that much for the next time I strike the note. And I'm bending the note at the same time. It's already bent up, or I bend it back up. Let's listen to that again. Until she falls in. This is a use of the diminished chord scale. Now, it really doesn't make sense with a chord, but it kind of does. Let's examine this. Yeah, Randy's moving the chord in there. I can hear the voicing. It's like B-flat minor 7-9 or B-flat minor 6-9, and he moves the 9 up to the minor 3rd on top during the section. There's more analysis of this, but what I'm getting at is I used a B-flat diminished scale over the whole thing, over that whole chord, and it kind of doesn't fit, but it does. It's an illusion. It's like, it's obviously a diminished scale, but the chord isn't diminished. So anyway, just what happened on the sperm of the moment. Let's see what happens after that. Takes us back to D minor, so B flat minor 6-9-ish with some moving voicing, and now we're back to D minor. And I'm just, you know, having fun whamming on the trem here and there, the tremolo bar here and there, you know, just trying to make it, just playing what I felt at the time. There's another pinched harmonic. Right there. The intended notes, but I'm hearing a 9. I'm hearing an interval of a 9th in the harmonic. I was just having fun, and that's the solo.
So how did that interlude idea start?
What's that?
The kind of like footsteps or knocking on the door.
There's a lyric reason for that. Let's find out what it is. And since Tim has a library that's ridiculous, you know, a sample library, I said, man, you have footsteps with a door slam? Actually, Randy said that. And we put it in. Obviously, three-part harmony, guitar harmony. When I arrive 2 hours late, she slams the door right in my face. Maybe that'll fit. Flip my phone and press star 8. in the outro, Randy and I asked Tim to do some more orchestra stuff, orchestral stuff. And there's a vocoder saying Donovan on some notes he's playing. Let's analyze it and see what it is. But now that I've mentioned it, you'll hear it. Normal. Isn't that a cool little out section? Really want it. You like it?
It's really great.
It's a puzzle. It all fits together.
It's really rich.
Trying to sing my R&B licks, which are very limited. My singing on this record, I'm the aggressive singer. Randy's mellower. He's got a much mellower voice, and I've got edge. I don't know if it's good or bad. I don't like my singing. Anyway, so...
Is that you singing on that record?
Huh?
Is that you singing on that record?
Oh, yeah.
Really? You sound like Joe Williams.
I do?
Yeah. I was about to ask you whether that was Joe Williams.
Really?
Yeah.
No, that's me, man.
That does actually... I was like, is that Joe Williams?
I'm going to tell Joe that. Let's see. I don't want to play all this track, but let's find a good spot.
Am I going mad?
Huh?
Am I going mad? Like, I swear it does sound like Joe Williams. Play again.
Okay. Let's find another section here.
Really, really, really want you make somebody care. Yeah. Stuff comes up road at the low road.
Oh, there's my best R&B lick.
Hit the high road at the low road.
This is Make Somebody.
Make Somebody. That was a long bend. Let's see what happened there. Oh, actually not bad.
If it's great, yeah.
I usually hate everything I play when I listen to it, but... So, let's, all right, so we'll just play this tune down. Let me see if I can find anything else to point out real quick, though. So is it just one trade-off with me and Ray? There's a load of them in this little turnaround. Actually, I'd have to sit down and analyze that one a little bit. I can't hear them all right off the top of my head. First tune we did. I came up with this chorus. This is why we became Jar. Let me find the chorus.
Girl, you know that is true. Color you blue.
Here comes the chorus.
You hear me singing.
So, chord, I don't wanna be your heartbreak. Okay, so I came up with that, and that's how Jar started, just from that one idea. I said, Randy, I've got a chorus. Let's work on this tune. And he says, well, why don't we be a band? And I said, okay.
Well, that's a great song.
It's just how it happened. So, well, there was something
great,
I was going to say.
Great melodic line there.
Yeah, it's memorable.
Yeah.
Girl, you know that is true.
Oh, I know what I was going to say. This is the most overused guitar fill there is on record starting from the 70s. Okay, this fill has been used a million times, okay? A million times. You've heard this so many times on so many records. But anyway, I played. And it's like, I'm almost embarrassed to myself for doing that. You know? Normally wouldn't do that. this ballad is as pretty as it gets, man. It's loaded with hip chord changes. Worlds Apart. Randy did a great job, as always, with the lyric, and he sounds real good on it. Oh, there's a good guitar. Well, there's a pretty okay guitar solo in it. Nylon string.
In between them.
Solo, man.
The ballads are always great.
Oh yeah, and it's just a gorgeous song. Let's see what else we got. Oh, I love film noir movies, and so does Randy. And the reason it's called Scene 29 is, I said, Rand, let's write a tune about film noir. There's also a total groove transition change that Randy and I like to do. Some of the sections that come up in songs, you just don't see them coming. And this is an example of that.
Put away your heater, Dick's laying down.
Okay, heater's slang for gun, and Dix or Bix, those kind of characters were in tons of noirs.
I was wondering about that line.
And there's some lines in the song that are direct lifts. You know, I had Randy watch specific noir movies to grab lines from, and there's a bunch of them in here.
The happiness boys are about to shout.
You know what? I think this got separated into a couple of tracks. It's not all here. Okay, there's an example for you, like the Donna Summer lick on the, what's the hit?
Bad Girls. Yeah.
Okay, so this is one of those kind of a feel tunes where I needed to come up with a guitar lick that felt funky, you know, and work for the groove. And this is it. Like the fundamental background thing for the vocal, right? It works well. And let's see if this tune's got some groove changes. Oh, the tune's about the chick's a GPS. She's the GPS of the car talking to us, right? Nah, so anyway, that it just fades out, but you can use that example in the rap. Scene 29, I think, has the transition to the solo. That's the whole bit. I mean, when the guitar solo comes up, the transition is, like, not expected. That's the reason to, you know, play that song, if I think that's right. Mm. I didn't get the full track for some reason or another.
Everybody should keep a lookout for Jay's YouTube channel, which is going to be out, if I'm right, in April?
Should be
launching in April. And that's going to be the new Rick Beato kind of style, but with obviously a wealth of history on record, on hit records. There are a few session players out there who've played on as much as you, written, arranged, recorded, whatever, produced. So, I mean, it's going to be, for music fans and for people who want to have a career in the industry, really useful resource. And, of course, for music nerds, like me included, who just want to find out about all this stuff, it's going to be a real resource, I think, out there.
It is. And especially the education as to recording in your DAWs regarding phase issues and all kinds of important stuff that's really needed.
Listen to C29, look out for the new Jar record, which you're mixing.
Right.
And look out for your YouTube channel. And I was also going to say, you know, thank you very much for coming on the Greatest Music of All Time podcast for a fourth time, I reckon. And, you know, long may these podcasts continue.
Hey, Tom, always a pleasure to see you and Debs, man. So come back as often as you'd like.
Oh, thank you, Jay.